Is Jim Masteller. I'm the founder of SIFT and on staff at Rock Harbor and still oversight with SIFT. So my feet are in the church world as well as the counseling world still. And I'm a retired Army chaplain, so I had military experience with all the stuff that goes with that. So this, what we're talking about this morning is really foundational to ministry. We care about people at the end of the day. And it's not always, it's a lot easier to stand up in front of people and preach to a crowd than it is oftentimes to sit with that one person who's so desperately lonely and hurting and to know what to do. So I commend you for being here, and I think we're going to have a good morning together. Let me pray for us, give you a couple of announcements, and then turn it over to Kevin to walk us through the morning. Father, thank you for the privilege we have, first of all, of knowing you and of being your children. What an incredible gift that you've given us to be in relationship with you, the God of the universe. And we can know you as our Heavenly Father. So, Father, help us to live out of that. Thank you for the calling that we have to serve you and for the incredible privilege to touch people's lives, not only with the gospel, but with our own personhood, with who we are as people, relating to one another. And help us to love as you love. Help us to speak truth as you speak truth. And so, Lord, I pray that this morning you would speak to our hearts, that we would be quickened and able to be good stewards of the ministry and the grace that you've given us. So thank you for each one who is here, for each church that's represented. And I just commit this time to you. In Jesus' name, amen. I'm always reminded of Bill Hybels' comment in Courageous Leadership when he says, the church is the hope of the world. And I really believe that there's no other group of people that are going to make the difference in people's lives like the church of Jesus Christ as we represent him. And how do we do that in people's lives? And so this morning, a couple of announcements. SIFT is committed to supporting, when we started this 23 years ago, we had two priorities. One was to be a training center where young therapists could get a good experience of how to integrate their faith with their psychology and how to be in a good work environment where they can support one another. And we're still doing that. We're still a training center. The other primary thing, and this was my priority, was how does SIFT come alongside the local church? If the church is the hope of the world, then our goal is simply to be Aaron and her, to support you and to help you in that local church ministry, because that, at the end of the day, is the front lines. And so our goal has been to come alongside and to help you. And one of the ways we help is to relieve the counseling burden from pastors. I don't want to take it completely off your shoulders. You need to be in touch with the hurts and the needs of your people. But you can get buried so quickly because there are so many people with deep needs that need ongoing help. And so part of my suggestion ever since we started in talking with pastors is have a policy. You know, see people three times max and refer them out if they need to be referred. Otherwise, you're going to either get buried by counseling or get people are going to resent you because how come you're seeing them every week and you won't see me twice? And so to have a clear policy is to your benefit. But then how do you know to refer? And so what do you refer? What are the signs that you look for that are beyond just pastoral counseling? And so that's the purpose of our time this morning, is to really delve into that and wrestle with that. Just for your awareness, our next pastors forum is October 9th. And Dr. John Townsend is coming back. Every time he's been here, he just hit a home run. And I just had breakfast with him Monday. And he's going to talk about being a leader that people want to follow. So I think it's going to be a rich time. So put that in your calendar now. And October 9th is our next pastor's forum. When we finish, Rob Fisher, who's now the executive director at SIFT, I'm kind of the CEO because I'm on staff at Rock Harbor and going to drive myself crazy. And so Rob Fisher is the executive director, doing a great job. And he's going to come back and talk to you about some of the stuff on the table, the soul care groups, because our goal is really to come alongside people in ministry. And this is another one of the ways we do it. So he'll wrap it up this morning and share some of those thoughts with you. We are honored to have Kevin Van Lant with us this morning. Kevin's PhD on staff at Biola within their counseling ministry and business. And he's been with SIFT. Man, we've been here 23 years. You've probably been here 18, 20, almost from the beginning. And he's now the executive, well, I don't know what your title is, director of counseling. Sir, he oversees all the clinical pieces. So he's done a great job over the years working with our staff, making sure they have the training and are equipped to do what they're called to do. And Kevin has done this workshop in multiple church staff settings, and we just thought it'd be good to invite churches in general to come. So we're glad you're here, and I think this is going to be important material. Kevin's a clinician as well as a faculty member and head of an area, and I mean, he's just had his fingers in a lot of pies and comes to you with a lot of wisdom. So I think you're in for a treat. Kevin, thanks for being here. God bless you.
How's that? Hold on. How's that? Okay. I'll try not to move around too much, although that might be difficult. Anyway, thank you for being here. It's Thursday mornings. I'm sure it's hard to get away for a few hours, and appreciate seeing you. I have done some version of this talk to a few different church staffs, and it seems like it's been generally pretty helpful. I have to struggle with not trying to squeeze too much in because I do teach abnormal psychology, an undergrad program at Biola, and then I've taught graduate level psychopathology for Rosemead School of Psychology a number of times. And so I'm really kind of squeezing in a few highlights from that just to give you a general sense of maybe what you might be looking for and attuned to and kind of thinking about with your congregation members. I did want to give you a brief example of a quick counseling session, so that you'll know what to have your church members prepared for. Let me see if I can make this happen. It was very serendipitous because this was actually on TV last night. And it's about a 2 or 3 minute clip with Jimmy Kimmel going to therapy with a 6-year-old therapist. And the highlight of this really is the last couple of comments by the 6-year-old. And see if you can sort of relate to this, those of you who do counseling, and certainly those of you who do clinical work. And hopefully the volume will
work. Health issues. I'm not ashamed to say that I speak to a psychiatrist every week. I'm ashamed to say what I tell the psychiatrist, but I'm not ashamed to tell you that I go. I think it's good to have someone to talk to. My guy's not your typical therapist. His name's Arden. He's young, but he's helped me a lot. And I thought it might be helpful for those of you who have not experienced therapy of any kind to listen in on one of my sessions. Just kind of, well, to see what it's like.
When I was a kid, there was a bigger kid that went to summer camp with. He used to, he'd squirt mustard down my pants, and then he would call me mustard butt. And now every time I smell mustard, I have to go in my room and cry.
Yeah, that's
kind of
a problem.
This weekend I'm going to a picnic.
Cool. Oh my gosh.
And
probably gonna be mustard there.
Yeah.
So we have to run down the block and go into your house and cry. It's kind of sad.
What should I do?
If I were you, I'd like tell your mom,
yeah,
and like have your mom talk to the guy who squirted mustard out.
But this was many years ago. I don't even know.
Right. I mean, well, that's what I would do if I were you.
Yeah, but I'm saying this happened like, you know, 40 years ago. We don't know where this kid is. I mean, he probably doesn't even remember that he did it.
He's probably like 64 now, and he doesn't even.
Yeah. But I'm worried about this weekend because I have to go to this picnic now, and I know there's going to be mustard there. And there's
yeah.
It's not like I can call ahead and say, hey, don't bring mustard to your picnic.
Yeah. So, but there's like, oh, everybody likes mustard.
That's how people are with mustard.
It's like, I don't like mustard either.
Really?
Yeah, I don't.
Oh, my God. I didn't know we had so much in common. Maybe what I'll do is, when I get to the picnic, I will...
Actually, you could just don't use the mustard.
That's a very good idea.
Yeah.
So you're saying I wouldn't use the mustard?
Yeah, since you have to cry about it.
That's a great idea.
And the mustard comes in a container, so you can't even smell it from there.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, because if you held it in your hands, it would be like glug, glug, glug.
Yeah, right. People are always like, you know? And I could just be like, glug, glug, glug. You know?
Well...
I shouldn't be like glug, glug, glug?
Actually, maybe you should.
I should be like glug, glug, glug. Who should I say that to?
Your mom.
Oh, that's my favorite part. Your mom.
Okay.
If only it were that easy, right? And only if the problems were that simple. So generally speaking, when I'm sort of thinking about someone in a clinical context, you know, I spent a lot of time. I did my PhD at Rosemead. We spent a lot of time talking about integration, talking about what it meant to sort of integrate a Christian worldview into our therapeutic approach, and that was good content. It was valuable training. The way I sort of think about it now, because I can only kind of hold three things in my brain at any given time, is I've kind of thought about integration as, at least in a clinical context, thinking about the individual that's in my office in these three veins. One is really the psychological self. What are they bringing in emotionally? What are they bringing in terms of their psychological history? And what is it in terms of diagnosis that I can really attend to with them? The other one is their spiritual life. Right? The spiritual life, a majority of my patients are Christians. They want to better understand how to attend to their spiritual life in a meaningful way, and certainly in terms of how that is impacting or being impacted by their psychological life. And then the biological life. I'm actually going to maybe put a little more emphasis on the biology today than one might think, because I'm not a psychiatrist. But the brain and biology has become sexy in the last 10, 15 years, right? We know a lot about the brain that we didn't know before. And so how does their biology and their physical experience affect how they're feeling psychologically, what they're experiencing spiritually? We know when we're, I don't know about you, but when I'm not feeling well, I'm not in a great mood. And when I'm not feeling well, oftentimes I'm not in a great mood about God either, right? So how we feel physically really does impact all of these things. And I'll try to really talk about each of them contextually. So this idea that somehow this great little, you know, red star here where they all come together and this is sort of the integrated self and our spiritual lives are balanced with our emotional lives and our biological lives. And this is the one little bit of movement here on the screen. The reality is that doesn't ever stay that way, right? And even if you do kind of get it to that point, it'll stay there for about a millisecond, and then your kids will start fighting, or you're, right? Or you'll, you know, you're not feeling so well, or something happens to you kind of emotionally that you're struggling with. So this is a dynamic kind of experience, and people's, I mean, you know this from your experience with people and just your experience with your own self. So this is always in flux, always moving, and clinically moves from session to session, from day to day. And so I'm pretty sure that will happen in terms of your work with some of the counselees as well. So kind of hold that in mind as we're talking about this. And by the way, this is a small enough group. I teach all the time. If you have questions, feel free to ask them. I'll leave some Q&A time at the end, but you're more than welcome to ask them as we go through too. The DSM-5, how many of you are familiar with the DSM? A little bit, yeah. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. This was updated this past year. A lot of people very excited about it. A lot of people very distressed about it. Some things people like, some things people don't. But the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual is really sort of the handbook in terms of what we think of as clinical diagnoses. And so there are certain criteria that have to be met. If you ever get a chance to kind of thumb through it, you know, if you have a bored minute and you want to take a look at this thing, I mean, there are hundreds of diagnoses in there, all with very specific criteria to be actually diagnosed with that particular disorder. However, a lot of people aren't necessarily in this psychopathological sort of domain. Some people are just eccentric, right? You may be one of those people. I may be one of those people. Certainly people in your congregation are. There are some people who aren't going to meet criteria for a diagnosis, but they really are sort of subclinical and sort of struggling with some things. The DSM doesn't really have a whole lot to say about those people. In fact, I would suggest to you that psychology in general doesn't have a whole lot to say about health. Psychology generally has been created around a pathology model. I think that's probably started to change a little bit in the last 10 years or so. But really, the general sort of growth of psychology was really about what does pathology look like and then how do we attend to it. But we don't have really a strong construct of what health is. The Bible does, right? The Bible has a very strong construct of what health is. And so this is another example of where you can kind of bring that spiritual component into it. Diagnosis, I'm not going to spend a ton of time on this, but I kind of break the DSM up into two major categories. One is kind of major areas of psychopathology, so major depression, anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, all those types of things. Those would be the sort of category of major psychological disorders, and we'll talk about a few of those. And the other one is personality disorders. You're familiar with personality disorders, yeah. We'll just talk about two of those. We'll talk about borderline personality disorder and narcissistic personality disorder because I think they're the most relevant to you in ministry. I'm not particularly Freudian. I always feel like I have to say that. However, in two very broad categories, Freud kind of talked about the notion that there are sort of two types of people in the world. He didn't really say that, but sort of. Kind of in his sort of context, people who take too much responsibility and people who don't take enough. And so for him, people who take too much responsibility would be considered kind of neurotic. And for Freud, he kind of thought, well, you know, neurotic's about the best we can get to in some ways, right? Just kind of a healthy neurosis. And then he would say, there are people who are character disordered, that was the old terminology for personality disorder, who are kind of characterologically disordered, and they tend to not take enough responsibility. And so that's sort of the tension, right? You have these people who really don't want to take responsibility for much that happens in their life, and those that tend to take way too much responsibility for what happens in their life, and trying to find that balance is usually a tricky point. So when we're defining actual pathology, and again, I'll go through this pretty quickly because I could spend a semester talking about this. I don't want that to go off. Deviance, what is deviant behavior? Well, the DSM tries to categorize what deviant behavior is. Those are the criteria. And so if you meet a certain number of those criteria, the thought is that you've deviated enough from what normal is that you might meet criteria for a diagnosis. Now, what's normal? Right? There's a lot of controversy over what normal is. Normal changes from culture to culture. And so normal is a tricky thing to find. And so, again, you want to hold on to this a little bit loosely, but that's part of what they do. Distress. Normally, the person has to have some subjective experience of distress for them to reach some kind of diagnostic criteria. Now, I would say someone who's bipolar and really in the height of a manic episode, they're not distressed. They think the world's their oyster, right? They're feeling really good. So there are a couple of examples here, maybe with narcissism, bipolar disorder. Maybe this doesn't actually kind of fit criteria, but most people feel the subjective nature of their distress. Dysfunction, things just aren't working out well in their relationships, in their life in general. I kind of hate that word dysfunction because it's been so overused. I'm fatigued of the word, but there really isn't a better word here for this. And then danger. This is someone who's either a danger to themselves or a danger to others, and I'm sure that this has been something you guys have talked about before. Fortunately, this is a relatively minority percentage of people who are dealing with pathology, but there are some that are going to come into your office who are going to be so depressed that they're thinking about taking their life, and they may not tell you that. So that's That gets complicated very quickly. The National Institute of Health in 2013, these numbers get thrown around and they're pretty wild sometimes, but the National Institute of Health, their research suggests that about 24% of Americans meet criteria for some diagnosis. Right? That's a lot of people. I don't really believe that 24% of people are mentally ill. That would be, my family maybe, I don't know. No, I'm joking. But 24%, that's a big number. I kind of hold that with a grain of salt. However, you have a lot of people in there that maybe are meeting criteria for multiple disorders. And then it does show you how subjective some of these criteria can be. Right? I always kind of joke with people, I was trained in graduate school. If you sit with me long enough, I'll find something wrong with you. And so there's this sort of sense in which you might be able to squeeze someone into a diagnosis if you really work at it. I try not to do that. Most people that come in have enough struggles without necessarily being diagnosed with something they're not really experiencing. However, it just kind of gives you a sense of the typical therapist, how are they kind of moving through their thought process about someone who does have a more severe diagnosis. I'm not talking about someone who's just coming in with marital problems or relationship issues and just wants some help kind of walking through some things. We're talking about people who are usually struggling pretty severely. Okay? So that's kind of the background on that. Probably the most common disorder of all are the depressive disorders. I sometimes think of depressive disorders as sort of the common cold of psychopathology. I mean, this is just so common and so rampant. And most people aren't necessarily going to be diagnosed as being depressed, even though they may very well be depressed. And we'll talk about maybe some of the differences between kind of maybe how males experience depression and how females experience depression. But you have a lot of people in your congregation who are depressed. You know that. You kind of see it from week to week. And being attuned to some of the symptoms of that might be important for you. This number, I think, probably I would believe. About 6.7, this is all from the National Institute of Health, by the way. 6.7% of Americans 18 and older are diagnosed with a depressive disorder in any given year. That number is probably reasonably accurate, at least subjectively from my experience with patients. So that's a pretty big number in your congregation, in your social relationships. 6.7% tends to add up pretty quickly. The median age of onset is 32, which is a lot older than some of the other disorders that we've been talking about today. So 32, these are people who are kind of establishing their lives, establishing their career. These are people who are already well underway in life and are now kind of confronting, I guess, some of those realities of life and are now maybe not any longer able to avoid some of the things that they've been trying to avoid. Was it Carl Jung said that most people's psychological problems are an attempt to avoid legitimate suffering, right? So these people have been avoiding legitimate suffering for a long time, and now the chickens are kind of coming home to roost oftentimes anyway. Depressive symptoms, they can be varied. The most obvious one is someone who's sad, right, who has a really severe level of sadness. Now, the DSM really tries to define for you what depression is. It's not just someone who's kind of sad, right? I mean, we all go through bouts of feeling sad sometimes. So depression isn't necessarily, in my mind, an emotion. Depression is a state. Right? And there are emotions that are attached to that state of depression. And some of the emotions you're going to find is a deep sadness. I find the biggest one is more of a hopelessness and a despair. When people come in and they're just feeling completely hopeless about the future, hopeless about the present, they're despairing. They may begin to feel like life isn't worth living. And so you start hearing some of the kind of suicidal ideation, which what's one of the criteria for major depression. They don't have to be suicidal to meet criteria, but that's one of them. And just this real sense that things are not going to get better. They don't know what to do. They feel powerless. They feel hopeless. And they just feel despairing. Right? And you've sat with people like that. The interesting thing, though, is that historically, females have been twice as likely to be diagnosed as males. And so that's sort of created a belief system that females experience depression at about twice the rate of males. That doesn't seem to be accurate. What it really maybe is more accurate about is that they're just diagnosed twice as often as males. I suspect that males are depressed at probably an equal rate. I could talk about this at length. There are times when I think that male depression is almost like epidemic in our country. Males are isolated. especially when they get to about middle age. There's sort of that midlife crisis thing that hits, and if they're not connected to a community, if they're not connected to people who really care about them, they get depressed pretty quickly. Males display different symptoms, at least from my experience. They tend to really downplay depressive symptomatology. So if you go and ask somebody in your church or somebody that's coming in for counseling, well, you know, it seems like maybe you're feeling depressed or you're feeling down, they'll minimize that. Males just tend to minimize that kind of symptomatology. So just because they say they're not feeling down, you don't necessarily want to believe that. If they're, I'll never forget, there was a time I had a pastor walk in from the waiting room. I had never met him before, from the waiting room into my office. And he walked in, and he was walking slowly and shuffling his feet, just flat. You know, his face was just flat. He just had all of the external sort of expressions of depression. Sat in, we talked for about half an hour, and at one point in time, I kind of mentioned to him that I kind of thought maybe he was struggling with depression. He says, yeah, I don't think so. So I kind of listed off, you know, why I kind of thought maybe he was struggling with depression. Yeah, that's exactly what my wife tells me, too, but I don't think so. I mean, the guy was just severely depressed. I mean, he was depressed in every area of his life, and so we spent some good time kind of talking through that. So downplaying is common. They're very reluctant, males in particular, very reluctant to get help. I don't know what the numbers are on that, but I would bet you that for every male that goes and seeks therapy, probably three females do. I'm just totally guessing on this. But males tend to be a little reluctant to get help. And so maybe part of your role, especially when we're talking about sort of, you know, pastoral counseling, and then when you decide you maybe want to refer them for more help, you may have to work a little harder to get them to make that call, because that is a tough call to make. In fact, when patients come in, I usually talk with them a bit about just how tough that first phone call can be and making that appointment, actually following up on that appointment. Very, very tricky. Somatic complaints or bodily complaints. Soma, just I think it means body in Latin. So males tend to oftentimes experience their depressive symptomatology in terms of how they feel physically. And so oftentimes, you know, they may not say, I'm depressed, but they'll tell you about their backache, and they'll tell you about the headaches they've been struggling with, and they'll tell you about various things that are more physical in nature, because it's just safer to express physical symptomatology than to express emotional symptomatology. Certain cultural groups, that's kind of common for as well, and feel free to speak up on this if you're from these groupings, but there is a fair amount of research to suggest that Asian Americans tend to present symptomatology more somatically than Caucasians or Latinos. And so, again, there are cultural aspects to some of this as well. Okay, I'll talk about treatment in a few minutes, but I'll just leave that with that. Any questions about depression before we kind of move on? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't say new, because that would accumulate pretty quickly. A lot of times the number looks more like about 9%. So we're talking about depressive disorders. So when you start adding bipolar disorder to that, dysthymia, some other depressive disorders, you're going to start bumping up to probably about 9.5%. So this is just depression. I don't know if that makes sense. So mood disorders are a big category. Yeah. Yes.
I've read books about the rise in teenage and adolescence.
Yeah, you know, I don't work a ton with adolescents anymore. I think I've aged out of adolescence a bit. There's a really nice book by Daniel Siegel right now on the adolescent brain, talking a great deal about sort of what's happening in that brain. He's a child psychiatrist up at UCLA. He's not a Christian, but probably one of the brightest minds on the developing brain that's out there. Definitely the depression rates among teenagers is increasing. Why that's the case, there are a lot of theories about that. I have my own theories about that, but with my own teenagers, I'm not sure I can talk them through objectively. But I'm convinced every culture has to confront various things. I remember many years ago, my grandmother told me, she said she had four sons all in World War II in combat at the same time, and obviously back then you didn't know how long they were going to be gone or if they were going to come back, and you didn't get to communicate with them via email. And she told me one day, she said, you know, Kevin, the old days, they weren't so good. Right? The old days, they weren't so good. And I think sometimes we kind of get in this category of thinking, because depression rates amongst males, or I'm sorry, among teenagers is higher, there's something sort of troubling about that population or what's going on culturally. I'm not so convinced that. I think we're so much more sensitive to diagnosis now, and the parents are looking for it much more readily. And I think we're seeing a lot of things that we just weren't looking for 15, 20 years ago. So the rates of of adolescent depression is definitely increasing. I just suspect that it's probably more about assessment and diagnosis than it is actual numbers. Teenagers have always had a rough patch. Adolescence is difficult inherently. But we could chat about that. But that's my sense anyway. But I'd really recommend Siegel's book on that. Yeah. I'm sorry? Yeah, I think kids... I don't know how long I want to go on that. I think kids are have highly unrealistic expectations about life and about the future. And I think it's kind of depressing because it's like playing in the NBA, right? There's going to be a small percentage are going to make to the NBA, and most of them are going to go to City College. And so what my impression is with teenagers is there's just tremendous pressure on certain populations of teenagers, and they can't handle the pressure. Depression rates amongst freshmen at Harvard is up to 80%, right? They're going to the most elite school in the country, right? And this is from a social psychologist at Harvard who was evaluating Harvard freshmen, found that they were depressed at about an 80 to 85% rate, met criteria for depression. Right, they were used to being the top dog. Right, they came from these schools and they were the cream of the crop, and now they're average. They go to Harvard, and all of a sudden I'm average, and they're just not prepared for that. So some authors talk about the teacup phenomena, that these kids are kind of brittle, like a porcelain teacup or china teacup. They're just not as durable and don't have as much grit as they need to. I have a lot of theories around this. We could talk a whole hour just about that, but there's some great writing out there on this, but. Okay. There'll be Q&A time at the end. Charlie Sheen is like the poster child for bipolar disorder. I remember we talk about him a lot in class when he was really kind of going through his, you know, his sort of gyrations. Bipolar disorder is a very complex, very severe, very troubling disorder, difficult to treat, difficult for the patients to endure and to manage. And so when you have when you have a member of your congregation who is struggling with bipolar disorder, know that they are suffering. They may come to church on Sunday and they kind of hold it together for an hour because they're usually pretty good at holding things together, but they struggle and they suffer and oftentimes don't have a lot of outlets for that. Bipolar disorder is essentially mania, which is just extreme sort of activity of the mind and the brain. They feel like they have way more money than they really do. They feel like they're all powerful. They don't need sleep. They just run at this manic kind of level just endlessly. And they usually crash at some point. And when they crash, then they usually crash into this depressive kind of disorder. About 2.5% roughly of the American population, 18 and over. I would say that this disorder is being diagnosed more and more as well. So why is that the case? I couldn't tell you other than, again, I think we're just more sensitive to it. We're diagnosing people who are maybe kind of hypomanic and maybe haven't met real criteria for mania, but we're just very, I think diagnosis and assessment, we're just very attuned to it now. Being diagnosed earlier and earlier, which I'm kind of troubled by personally. So you have young kids that are getting diagnosed with bipolar disorder and maybe going on medications for bipolar disorder, you know, at 13, 12, 14. I'm reluctant on that one, but I'm not a psychiatrist, but I have some real misgivings at times with that. Median age of onset, about 25. This is a disorder that people start to notice. Oftentimes gets misdiagnosed in the beginning as psychosis. They usually get diagnosed in the ER, and the ER doc oftentimes gives them a diagnosis of schizophrenia or psychosis. Some big issues. And this is just kind of what to be aware of with members of your congregation who are struggling with bipolar disorder. Medication compliance is probably the most difficult thing to kind of walk through with a typical bipolar patient because they don't like how the medications make them feel. And frankly, I wouldn't like how they would make me feel either. So they're constantly kind of wanting to shift away or shift off of the medications or go with a lighter dose of the medications. The other component with bipolar disorder, a little bit unlike depression, is that sometimes with depression, you get them on the right dose of the right medication, and they may stay on that dose and that medication for years, and it really can benefit them. With a bipolar patient, what I find is that they're constantly adjusting the dosages. They're either adjusting the dosage or they're changing the medications because it seems like something's going on with their biology that's kind of constantly shifting and adapting as well. And so it's a very dynamic disorder in a lot of ways, and the medication compliance is a huge issue for these patients. And the medications are kind of nasty, too. They're not the kinds of meds that people tend to gravitate towards. Substance abuse is huge. I would say in my career, I don't know how many bipolar patients I've worked with, at least 80% of them are struggling with or have struggled with substance abuse issues. You know, they've been trying to self-medicate since they were 17, and now they're, you know, 28, 30, and now they have the substance abuse issue and the bipolar disorder. You get the bipolar disorder sort of under control, and all those addiction issues that were there kind of hidden start working their way to the surface. And this is just a very complicated disorder to work with. They need a psychiatrist, and they need a psychiatrist that they have an ongoing relationship with, that they're willing to see regularly, and are really being evaluated sort of ongoingly for their meds. And so this is not a patient who can go for long periods of time without seeing their doctor. They just aren't. They'll definitely go into a spiral pretty quickly. Okay. Yes. They should see a therapist too, because a psychiatrist will see them maybe once a quarter, right? And I find with the bipolar patients that I work with, I'm interacting with their psychiatrist quite a bit because I'm seeing them, you know, every week or two, and so I have a much better handle on what's going on. And so oftentimes I'll pick up the phone and call the psychiatrist and say I'm noticing this, and then he'll call and bring them in, and then they'll kind of work on the meds. But this is a complicated one, to say the least. Yeah. Thank you. Sure.
What role should a pastor have with a psychiatrist, psychologist, taking care of the health care of that individual in your congregation?
Yeah.
They have a psychiatrist and a
psychologist. Yeah.
Take over. Well, we have to care for them.
Sure.
Sure. Join your small groups.
How about this, Dave? I have a slide that I'll talk about that with, and then if I don't answer it, just poke me or something, okay? Okay, anxiety. I'll go through this fairly quickly. About 18% of Americans over 18 meet criteria for anxiety disorders. Anxiety is the flip side of depression. I always think of anxiety as sort of the opposite side of the coin of depression. It's just which one tends to be sort of leaking through at the time. So oftentimes people have a primary diagnosis of depression, very commonly have another diagnosis of anxiety or sort of a subclinical level of anxiety, or vice versa. So you tend to see these two things in tandem a great deal. Often co-occurs, like I said, with depression. Substance abuse is common, especially things that are sedating, like alcohol, right? A lot of things that kind of calm us down, they tend to be quite vulnerable to. It's different than normal worry. You know, we all have our worries. We worry about our kids, about your churches, about our patients, about students, whatever it might be. We all have our various worries. This is where worry sort of runs amok. This is worry that's sort of out of control, where they can't contain it, they can't calm themselves down, and this is going to look like a couple of things that I'll mention here in a minute. There are a couple of really significant biological components that are going on with someone who carries a lot of anxiety, primarily with the amygdala, and then this anterior cingulate cortex. You didn't think you were going to talk about that this morning, did you? But I would say primarily we're really kind of hitting at that amygdala, because that amygdala is very active in emotion regulation. And so there's a fair amount of interesting sort of research out there. Who wrote Anatomy of the Soul? Yeah, thank you, Kurt Thompson. That's a really interesting book to read in terms of sort of how the anatomy kind of comes into play with one's psychology. But what you find is when one's born, and I'm not going to spend a ton of time on this, but when one is born, this is fully online, right? You're born, and you're ready to be afraid, and you're ready to get mad, and you're ready to be scared, you're ready to be upset, you're ready to, like, you have a dirty pants, and you're ready to start crying, Right? That amygdala is really kind of making those systems work for you when you're born. What's not online is this, right? The cortex is something that develops over a period of our entire lives. And so a lot of times what some of the thought is anyway is you have this amygdala that's really running amok, and you don't have a lot of connection to the cortex which is able to make sense of it, such as the prefrontal cortex, such as I've heard a sound outside, it's probably just the wind blowing, right, as opposed to I'm sure that there's someone trying to break into my house. It's the prefrontal cortex that kind of talks us through that a bit. Again, I could spend a whole bunch of time talking about anxiety, but I'll kind of move on. Generalized anxiety disorder is sort of the most common of the disorders. Panic disorder, which is very frequent. A lot of people have panic disorders. About 30% develop into what's called agoraphobia. And every once in a while you hear about an agoraphobic on TV or something that hasn't left their house in 10 years, right? The agoraphobic is just really anxious about going into sort of exposed places. Agora means the marketplace. They're phobic of the marketplace, which is really they're afraid to come to your church, right? Because they don't feel like they can escape readily. They're afraid to go to Target. They're afraid to go almost anywhere, and they can get pretty housebound. Pretty common diagnosis. OCD. If you've gone to graduate school, you probably have a little OCD trait in you somewhere, and you make it work for you. This is really when it kind of gets so far over the top that it becomes dysfunctional to the point that the person can't really function in their society well. Treatment. Anxiety disorders are quite treatable. In fact, it kind of makes me sad to see someone who really suffers with anxiety disorders, you know, for decades, because they're amongst the more treatable of the diagnoses, and the combination oftentimes of medication and therapy, or sometimes just therapy, or sometimes just medication, but I really recommend both. You can get at the bottom of anxiety, I wouldn't say easily, but well, you can sure get a lot of symptom relief fairly quickly with the right combination of work. So I really, if you have someone in your congregation that really struggles with anxiety and isn't getting help, that's kind of heartbreaking, because there's a lot of help available, particularly for this set of symptoms. PTSD, we hear more and more about this. I'm talking about the things I think you're most likely to see in your congregations. Right? There are dozens more diagnoses here. Post-traumatic stress disorder. I used to work at a VA hospital years ago. Saw a lot of Vietnam patients who were struggling with PTSD in the first Gulf War. What happens with them is that they're traumatized in whatever scenario it might be. Could be war, could be earthquake, could be just some kind of major environmental trauma. And that trauma, we tend to remember things. I always use this example in my class. Most of you remember your first kiss, right? You all remember your first kiss. I would venture to say none of you remember your 10th kiss, right? Or your 5th kiss, maybe even your 2nd kiss. Why do you think that is? Why do you think you remember the first one so clearly? Jim, you remember your first kiss probably, don't you?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, you do. He doesn't want to say because Sally might find out, right? There's so much emotion attached to that first kiss, right? When you think about it, right, there's excitement and fear, and there's just lots of affect connected to that first kiss. Well, when we're traumatized, right, when we're traumatized, there's so much emotion attached to that event, and we have a very difficult time uncoupling that event from the emotion. And PTSD is really where the patient just can't separate those two things out, or can't make sense of them enough to be at peace, or can't put them into adult language enough that they're able to really kind of make sense of it clearly. And PTSD is just very distressing. Others experience it as sort of an overreaction because they just don't know what's really going on. They avoid situations that remind them of the event. Lots of agitation, depression, anxiety. I mean, there are all kinds of sub-diagnoses sort of under PTSD. I had a former TA of mine at Biola Rosemead who went into the Army as a Army psychologist, spent a couple of tours over in Afghanistan, and really came back just traumatized. They put them closer and closer to the front lines now. In fact, I think I sent them to you. I can't remember. But they put them closer and closer to the front lines because what they're trying to do is they're trying to help these combat soldiers talk about their traumatizing events as soon as possible. But what's interesting is then they're putting the psychologist right there near the front line, and they're talking about these traumatic events over and over and over with all of these soldiers. And so they're just they're experiencing it almost secondhand, but nonetheless very distressing. Who's vulnerable to it? Pretty much everyone. But the younger, the more you tend to be vulnerable than the older, right? So the more you can sort of make adult language connect with the trauma, you tend to be a little less vulnerable. Treatment's very complex, again, oftentimes misdiagnosed or underdiagnosed because most trauma happens in childhood. And so most patients who really have PTSD that will come into your office at the church or come into my office, usually it's because of early childhood trauma, sexual abuse, physical abuse, that kind of thing. But it really doesn't oftentimes get diagnosed as PTSD, even though they're acting in a post-traumatic way, right? And so when the soldier comes back, we're sort of primed for that, or the firefighter or the 9/11 guy, whatever, we're primed for that. But when someone comes to your office who really doesn't talk about their early childhood trauma, they're still acting in a traumatized fashion, and just kind of being attuned to that's important. And then non-traumatic stress, we all have that. Try to keep an eye on the clock, because we have to end at some point. Okay, addiction and substance abuse. This is one of those great topics I'd love to talk about just because it's so common. A couple of things I would just really say neurologically that's going on with the person who's struggling with addiction, and that is this whole sort of dopamine system. Dopamine's a neurotransmitter. It's very involved in the pleasure centers and reward centers of the brain. When you go out to a nice dinner and whatever you happen to like, salmon or steak or lobster or whatever else it is, and you eat this wonderful meal and your tummy feels good and you're enjoying the conversation. That's because when you eat good food, you get a dopamine rush, right? When you have sex, you get a dopamine rush, right? When all these things happen, dopamine just kind of floods the system. We like dopamine. As human beings, we love dopamine. The problem is when we're abusing drugs or addicted to various things, I would say including pornography, what's happening is that these dopamine processes, the system is overly active. And so the nucleus accumbens is really kind of the primary portion that I'm interested in. But the nucleus accumbens is where dopamine sort of gets directed. You have someone in your congregation who's abusing cocaine, who's abusing Ritalin, who's abusing kind of any type of amphetamine. That system is off the charts, right? That system is just very, very active. And gets depleted very quickly, and we'll talk about that a bit. THC or marijuana, my students at Biola are so interested in this because the culture is just so conflicted, and it's such a confusing topic within the culture. I would just say a couple of things, mostly because I think you're going to get confronted with this quite a bit. You're going to have a lot of people in your congregation. If you work with youth, you're going to have a lot of youth who are going to either be using marijuana or certainly have used it occasionally. There are a few things about THC. It's not the safe drug. The kids are convinced, by the way, the teenagers are convinced that marijuana is no worse than alcohol, certainly, and there's no reason why they shouldn't use it. It's actually pretty safe. People have been using it for thousands of years. But there are a couple of really huge aspects that they don't understand. One is this whole notion of the amotivational syndrome. Amotivational syndrome is when you start smoking a fair amount of weed, you get really disinterested in doing other things and investing yourself in things that are actually difficult. And so when you see someone who's been smoking a fair amount of weed, typically what they're doing is they're really retreating a lot from life, and they're certainly retreating from the things that are demanding much of them. And so this is super common. I feel like we're dumbing down a whole, 50% of teenagers, they were just dumbing them down through this process. Short-term memory, highly impacted by marijuana use. I had a patient one time who was a bright, bright person studying for to be an actuary. And there are lots of tests that are part of the actuarial process. Had passed the first two or three of them, I think had two or three more. Had a long history of marijuana use before I had been working with her. And then she went through a really traumatic event, started smoking weed again. She never passed another test. Never passed, just couldn't. She couldn't retain the information. She took the test probably half a dozen times, but just couldn't get past it and finally just gave up on it. So short-term memory, highly impacted. And then I think one of the biggest issues is that this is not your, you know, this is not your parents' weed. The marijuana that's being used today is much more potent than the marijuana from 15, 20 years ago. And so the effect is much more intense. You're even seeing psychosis taking place in some of the kids that are using weed now. So this is not a benign thing. And the kids don't like to hear that, but it's true.
Is the short-term memory loss reversible?
Yeah, I think for most of them. They'll never remember what they don't remember, right? It's like an alcoholic who has Korsakoff syndrome. They'll never pick up what they weren't experiencing, but they can begin to remember new information. But yeah, I think a lot of it is reversible. Alcohol, you know, we all know about that. Alcohol works on a whole different system, though, called GABA. Dopamine's kind of implicated, but it's mostly just GABA, and I don't have a lot of time to do that. Pornography, I would suggest to you that pornography really activates the same systems. It really activates this dopamine system, and it feels good, and that's why we're just kind of drawn back to pornography over and over, especially with males, and that could be its own talk, too. Recovery. I'm a big believer in AA. I'm a big believer in Celebrate Recovery. I think people need a community, and they need a group of people that they can be honest with and be real with. I tell, when I teach abnormal psych and psychopathology, I make all of my students go to an AA meeting. And they're usually anxious about it. They don't really want to go. But they always come back telling me how great it was. They come back and they say to me, I wish church were more like AA. Right? These people, they're just out there. They're not hiding. They're telling you the truth of what's going on. They're not pretending like they're okay when they're really not. And so there is something about that environment that I think really is just crucial for these individuals who are struggling. One thing that I would just throw out here real quickly on this at the end is that when you've been using substances for a while, or I would suggest even with pornography use, that what the brain does in response to having too much dopamine is it starts doing what we call pruning. It starts pruning the dopamine receptors. And so what that means is that it takes more dopamine to get the same experience that you used to have earlier on in your addictive process, in your addictive life. Some of that can be reversed, some of that can't. Right? Especially for people who've been using pretty hardcore cocaine, methamphetamine for quite a while. They may never quite get back to where they were before. I've had patients who have experienced psychosis because dopamine is highly implicated in schizophrenia, right? So you have people who use hardcore substances for a while, they'll develop a psychosis and they'll never come back from it. The brain's a funny thing. It's very durable in one sense and it's very fragile in another. And so when I talk to my kids about substance use and I talk to my kids about the brain, I say, look, you're going to have one kid who's going to go through some kind of substance use history and they're going to be fine. They're going to stop using and everything's going to be fine. And you're going to have another person that may use quite a bit less, and they're not going to come out fine because no one's brain responds to this stuff the same way, just like no one's brain responds to medication the same way. So this is a whole area of treatment. The church, I think, probably the best thing the church can do is really offer recovery kinds of ministries within the church, but it's a very specialized area of treatment. Okay? I'm already behind. Okay. This cartoon, if you can't read it, says, Katya, I know that with the right combination of therapy and medication, I could have a committed relationship with you. Right? So this idea of kind of what do we do with medication? We feel, I think sometimes in the church, my experience has been we're a little conflicted about medication. A lot of people in your congregation, if they are on medication, might feel kind of ashamed about it. I don't know if they'll talk with you or not about it, but medication is just everywhere. Antidepressant use, among the most frequently used medication in the country by people between the ages of 18 and 44. It's a very, very commonly prescribed medication. Prescribed not just by psychiatrists, but prescribed by your GP. Lots of physicians, OBGYNs, will prescribe various antidepressant medications. So this is a really common med that's out there. About 11% of Americans over the age of 12 take antidepressants. Right? That's a big number, 11% over 12. And they're being given medications earlier and earlier, and that's a whole other conversation, too. 23% of women ages 40 to 59 take antidepressants more than in any other age or gender group. So you have a lot of folks out there taking medications. And so I want to just highlight three categories of medication, just so you might already know about these, and if you do, great, and if you don't, just hang on. I'm going to talk about them very quickly. The first one is what we call an SSRI, or a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. Probably the most commonly prescribed antidepressant, but it's also used for anxiety. So a lot of people may take one version of this is Lexapro. People may take Lexapro for anxiety, not just for depression, because it works on the serotonin system, and the serotonin system is implicated in both depression and anxiety. Kind of like I mentioned before, they kind of go in pairs. It's a very safe medication, by and large. I know there's been some interesting sort of stuff that's come out in the past few years or several years about increased suicidal rates amongst people who are on SSRIs. My sense of that is they probably were already pretty vulnerable to suicidality, and so that's one of the reasons why you see an increased spike in that. But it, what it does is it tries to slow the process of reuptaking serotonin and keeps it in that synapse just a little bit longer. And if you can keep serotonin in that synapse just a little bit longer, oftentimes people experience a relief in depression rates. So it's pretty safe, pretty commonly used. I would say over-prescribed and probably over-prescribed in terms of dosage as well. So it's not like I'm sitting here saying, yeah, everyone should be on it. I think people probably need to be a little more cautious about it. I like to see people get these medications from a psychiatrist or a neurologist rather than their GP. Some GPs are really sharp, but most GPs have like two antidepressants that they feel comfortable with, and they prescribe those two to everyone, whereas there's probably 50 or more of them out there, and they all have slightly different side effect profiles. So I really do like to see a psychiatrist prescribe them. Benzodiazepines, Valium, Xanax, Klonopin, highly addictive, right? Highly addictive, work on the same receptors as alcohol. They work on GABA receptors. Highly prescribed as well. It's one of the medications you notice your doctor has to fill out a triplicate form to get if you ever get one. So they're not bad, but they're highly addictive, and people misuse them very frequently. So you might, if you hear someone saying that they're taking Valium or taking Klonopin or something like that, you might inquire as to the level. Mood stabilizers like Abilify and whatnot, especially with bipolar disorder, very, very helpful as well. Those are probably amongst the most frequently prescribed medication. We could clearly, I needed more time. I'm attracted to you, but then I'm attracted to me too, says the guy as he's talking with this gal. Personality disorders are an enduring pattern of inner experience and behavior that deviates from the expectations of the culture and from the individuals who and the individual who exhibits it. What a personality disorder is, it's oftentimes a very early developmental problem. Personality disorders don't come upon you at 18. They come upon, they start developing at 3. Right? They start kind of working their way through. There are two that I think are most important for you guys to be aware of if you're not already. One of those is the borderline personality disorder. I have worked with at least a few pastors whose ministries have been taken down by having affairs with women who have borderline personality disorder. These are people who have very unstable senses of self. Right? They are not grounded. They look to people who have authority, who have power, who have influence. They're drawn to those people, and they want to attach to them. And the attachment can become very insidious. They'll be calling you a lot. They need you. They'll elevate you, tell you how great you are, how much your ministry means to them, right? And it's a slow, kind of insidious process. And if the pastor is not tuned into it, it will go south pretty quickly. And they will create scenarios that aren't real, right? Their connection to reality is a little loose. And so even though something may not have happened exactly the way they said it has, oftentimes they're believed. And so you just have to be cautious. When you start seeing the signs, right, you guys should be careful. Narcissistic personality disorder, this is the grandiose person who thinks they're the greatest, right? We all kind of, narcissism has become sort of epidemic in the culture, I think. Certainly the term is used much more. 20 years ago, no one used the term narcissism. It's interesting. I'd never heard it used. Now it's like everyone's narcissistic, which everyone's not. But the ones who are will make your life difficult. And the main thing with both the borderline personality and the narcissistic personality is that they're very good at this thing we call splitting. And splitting is going from what was kind of all good to all bad very quickly, right? So one day you're the greatest, and one day you're the worst pastor they've ever met, right? These are difficult disorders to work with, even when the person really wants to work on them. So if you don't know much about them, I would suggest just doing some of your own research because they're important. Yeah.
You can have a narcissist and bipolar. I mean, you can
mix and match. Yeah, it's like a buffet. Yeah. Now, you can have what we used to call an axis 1 disorder, which might be bipolar disorder, and then an axis 2 disorder, which these categories don't work anymore. But, you know, you can, but oftentimes the personality disorder kind of predominates. Sometimes with a bipolar patient, you'll see a lot of depression, and that's all in there, but it's usually kind of subsumed under all of the personality factors of the disorder, the personality disorder. So it gets pretty wild. Yeah. Yeah, the males, definitely males tend to be, probably 80-90% of narcissists tend to be males. Probably 80-90% of borderlines tend to be female. Yeah, for sure.
Are they related in some way?
Well, kind of. Yeah, sometimes you'll see some similar traits, some personality traits, and there is some crossover in there. They do have their own distinct sort of components, though, too. How much trouble do you want to get me in here? Psychologists, medical doctors, pastors. I would say narcissism is a little overrepresented in these professions, so I'm throwing myself in the same category. And I think there's a vulnerability to that whenever you have a role where you immediately have a certain amount of elevation or sort of respect for being in that role, not necessarily respect for who you are, right? And so probably any profession, politics, acting, right? Any profession where you really get elevated very quickly without people really having to know you well, probably there's a vulnerability to that. We're kind of drawn to that. So, you know, a good gut check is probably a good thing to have at times. Okay, I probably prepared too much here, which is usually my problem. When it comes to collaboration, Dave, this was your question a little earlier. I'm all for collaboration. And I think SIFT as a group is all for collaboration. We like to collaborate. There's a great, if you ever get a chance, I'm not going to be able to talk about this very long, but Oscar Pfister, who was a Lutheran pastor back in the early 1900s, had a very close relationship with Sigmund Freud. There's correspondence between the two of them that happened over 20 or 30 years. Freud, as you might know, was very antagonistic towards religion. And Pfister stayed very true to the faith. And Pfister had, they really liked each other, even though they had a very strong difference of opinion about the sort of the role of God. Freud wrote a book called The Future of Future of an Illusion, and Pfister wrote a book called The Illusion of the Future. So they were interesting people. If you ever get a chance to do a little bit of reading on them, they're actually kind of fun to read about. Come on. I would suggest that you develop a relationship with a therapist or two, with SIFT or with wherever, and a psychiatrist or two. And I would suggest that it would be important because I get a call every once in a while from a pastor who will just sort of ask me some general things about someone in their congregation that they're kind of worried about. And I think it would be helpful for you, if you don't already have that kind of relationship, that you have a person or two that you've gotten to know a little bit, whose opinion you kind of respect, that you can talk to and get feedback when you feel concerned about someone. I think that's huge. I really do think that's beneficial. It's going to save you a lot of time, too. So I'm sure there are staff members here who would be happy to do that with you. Cartoon says, I'm doing a lot better now that I'm back in denial. Denial's awesome, if you can stay there. Couple of things about collaboration. One is, as you probably know, the patient holds the privilege. We don't hold the privilege of that person's confidentiality. So for us to talk to you means that they have to sign a release of information to have that interaction with you. Sometimes patients aren't always open to that. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. Part of the reason they may not be open to it is that they're sort of uncomfortable with the limits of confidentiality. So theoretically, if I'm seeing a patient and you're their pastor, and they've signed a release that's just a broad release. Theoretically, I can tell you anything about what's going on with the patient. Now, I'll probably use good judgment around that, but they don't know that, and they're worried. They're telling me some of their deepest, darkest secrets, and they're not sure that they want that to go out. So a couple of things that might be helpful. One is kind of depends on the patient, the pastor, and the kind of relationship you have with them, and the kind of counseling relationship you might have with them, is some kind of limited release, where you can interact with the therapist and just get sort of broad Which is oftentimes, I think, the only thing you really want anyway, just kind of a broad sense of what's going on with the patient, and that can be discussed and worked through, and I'd encourage you to think about that. Talk about your congregation, talk to your congregation member about that. I think sometimes if it's a particularly tricky situation and you call me, I may not even be able to tell you that I'm seeing them, right? I mean, the limits of confidentiality are pretty tight, and so it probably works best if you can kind of work through them. But if you were to call someone and not get a call back, it's probably because they're not quite allowed to tell you much. But this gets tricky, but I think it can be worked through. I think it's really helpful when the pastor, who I think generally really cares about this person and can kind of get a sense of what's going on from the therapist so that they know how to help them. I think that's huge. And I think it's huge with a psychiatrist as well, if you can do that. Yeah. Well, family members have no access to anything more than you do, unless they're a minor. If they're a minor, there's a whole different set of laws around that. But yeah, the family members don't. Yeah. You wish they did. Like, there are times when I wish I could call the family member because I think it'd be so helpful. Steps you can take. I'm aware of the time, so we have just like 2 minutes. I would say what Jim mentioned earlier, create a church policy regarding suggested limits. You might think about how many pastoral... I can make this PowerPoint available to y'all, too, so Kirsten can shoot that off to you. Consultation with other staff members, I think, is important. So if you have someone that you're working with in a counseling environment or just struggling with, I think interacting with some of your colleagues about it can be really helpful because they'll either say, well, put the brakes on, or well, try this. Or, you know, that I think that can actually be really beneficial. You might have a staff member who receives more training in pastoral counseling, gets a little more background in what to kind of do with these types of congregation members. Brief supportive care rather than long-term or in-depth counseling, they'll consume you, right? They'll consume your ministry. I know this sounds odd, but I would actually encourage you to go and visit an AA meeting or an Al-Anon meeting just to kind of get a sense, go as a visitor. There are open meetings, you know, just go as a visitor, kind of get a sense of what that environment's like if you happen to be in a church where this is something you're confronting off and on, because I think it'd be really helpful for you. Get to know some other therapists in your referral network, like we talked about. Confer with them, like I already mentioned. Have the person speak to your staff on the recent developments in the field of mental health, perhaps every year or two. So if you get kind of a relationship built and you have a, you know, you have a staff of a few people, you might have this person come out, buy them lunch. They'll do anything for lunch and a coffee. So have them come out, just kind of update you on what's going on. If there's specific questions you want to ask, I think oftentimes people would be willing to do that. I know lots of our staff would be willing to do that. And then some resources, and again, I'll send you this this PowerPoint. This is called the Church Leaders Counseling Resource Book, A Guide to Mental Health and Social Problems. It's a pretty good book covering a broad range of psychological issues and what to do with them in the context of the church, right? This isn't how to be a pastoral counselor for these various things. It's sort of how to think about them as a pastor, and I think it's quite good. Not because I have a chapter in that, that's not why, but I think it's quite good just because it covers so much, and I think they did a nice job with that. I like Henry Cloud's work, and I like it a lot because I think it speaks to some of the things you as leaders are struggling with, how to kind of end a counseling relationship, perhaps, with someone you've been working with, and kind of how to think about you might be referring them on. How to lead, I think, is huge. This guy is not a Christian, but I really like this book. It's brand new. Recover to Live. He was a hardcore addict for probably 15, 20 years. He's Peter Lawford's son. I think he's a Kennedy by marriage, too. But I think quite good in terms of understanding addiction and the nature of the breadth of it. So I like it. He's kind of a wild card, but I like it. Of course, us as a resource. You know that, or you wouldn't be here. And then the Alliance on Mental Illness, National Alliance on Mental Illness. You can get on their website. Lots of information there about various forms of psychopathology and more severe forms. So that's all I have. I'm sorry I had to go through some of it so quickly, but I don't know if we have a minute or two for questions or what. Yeah.
Opinions on medical marijuana?
I'm not a fan. I think there's a role for medical marijuana. It's just that most of the 98% of marijuana that's prescribed isn't really prescribed for medical use. I think if it were prescribed the way other medications were prescribed and really was taking place more in the hospital, I think there are legitimate uses for it. someone who's under chemotherapy, glaucoma. There are a few different, I think there are legitimate reasons or uses for it, but our country is just so messed up on it that it's like the Wild West out there when it comes to it. So I'm not a big fan. If they really reined it in, the federal government really took control of it, yeah, I think there are. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where's that point where we say, oh, you know, I think it's okay, so-and-so, they're all right, they're not causing too much of a distraction.
Yeah.
And where's that point where we say, I think we need to, this is over my head, I need to know.
I think if you're already beginning to think that, then you've already made the decision, or should make the decision. So if you're already thinking, this person, I'm sketchy about what's going on with this person, I'd really encourage you to encourage them to go get assessed and just meet with someone and kind of talk it through. Maybe there really isn't anything severe enough going on that they're going to need help. But, boy, you know, David Letterman said, when you think someone's odd, they probably are, right? So if you think something's going on, there probably is something going on. Yeah.
Are there different resources or different approaches for the few of us that are dealing with you in the industry and seeing our students, our 14-year-olds? And
yeah. Yeah, boy, that's another hour. I know he's not a Christian, but I still think there's so much worthwhile in it. I would really recommend you pick up Daniel Siegel's book. It's brand new on the teenage brain, because the teenage brain's a different animal. And what you're doing with that person, I think being able to think that through a little more clearly. His name's Daniel Siegel. He's a child psychiatrist out of UCLA, but I'd recommend picking that up. I think it's he's well ahead of anything in the Christian world that you're going to find. So maybe read that and then kind of backfill it with whatever Christian resources you can. But he's just so far ahead of anything that's being written about in the Christian world. I wish I had a better answer for that, but it's just so long. Yeah.
I'm struggling with people that are attending my church who are clearly broken.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to help hurting people. So I have a lady I just referred to, like, suspect she's schizophrenic.
Yeah. Where's my watch? I don't even know how to respond to that. Maybe we could talk about it after the meeting today. But that's a tricky scenario, because you don't want to alienate this person. You want to really try to minister to her. But if she's so disruptive that it's making ministry to the rest of this group difficult, I would definitely say you'd want to consult with someone who deals with schizophrenia, to kind of maybe consult with the psychiatrist, see if she's even getting treatment. That may be a requirement for her to participate, if she has to get some kind of treatment. But that's such a long answer. I don't even know how to answer that in a few minutes. But it's a great question. I'm sure it's something you confront. I know we're out of time, so I'm going to end. And if you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer them afterwards.
Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate it. And if you guys have questions afterwards, we'll be around to hang out and answer those in person. I know Kevin can maybe hang out for a few minutes. I'll be here. Jim will be here. And then Sue and Kirsten in the back too. But we just appreciate you guys coming in this morning and taking this seriously and really wanting to partner together. And as Jim and Kevin both said, we want to be that resource for you guys. So if you can't stay today, but you have a question, shoot us an email or give us a phone call or whatever it might be. We want to make ourselves available. And as Kevin said too, we're happy to come out and do a training with your staff, or just meet for lunch or coffee or breakfast or whatever it is. We'll even pay for that. And so you guys can keep your budgets a little bit reserved there. And I just want to highlight a couple quick things. One is we actually had our staff development day, which is our yearly retreat, this past Saturday. And we've got about 50 clinicians. And once a year, we get to come together and just, you know, kind of celebrate. We get to build community and talk about the values of SIFT. And one of the things that we do is just start the day off by spending some time in prayer and in God's word. And this past Saturday, we spent some time in John 13. and just looking at Jesus washing the disciples' feet. And I was just struck by a couple things in there that I want to kind of share with you guys to speak about soul care. Because we've talked about soul care at each of our forums and the importance and the significance and the value of those relationships in that community. And as I spent some time in this passage, I was struck by just Jesus's knowledge. Jesus's knowledge of who he was and whose he was, right? And it says Jesus, you know, was given all authority, yet, you know, he served. And I think about these soul care communities and really the opportunity to abide in the vine and just know who we are and know whose we are and to slow down because life's busy. It's busy for all of us. And it's easy to get caught up in all of that. But these soul care groups, it's not a huge commitment, right? It's 2 hours once a month. But it's an opportunity for you to slow down and it's an opportunity for you to be cared for and nurtured and for your soul to get some of that food, that nourishment that each of our souls needs. So there's some signups in the back for that if you guys are interested in a soul care group. We've got groups in orange. We've got a women in ministry group, two of those there, a men in ministry group in orange. We've also got a men in ministry group that's out in Los Alamitos. And then we've got some groups for pastors' wives, too. So I'd encourage you to look into that. A couple other things. We've got some resources back there for you guys in terms of books. And so if you see a book back there that you like, grab it. If you see two that you like, grab both of them. If you see three that you like, grab as many as you need. Those are just a resource for you guys because we want to be sure that we're putting things in your hands that we feel like might be useful and helpful for you. And then the other things that are back there are just some resources for you guys about groups that we run. We've got a group for men who have sexual issues that they're struggling with. We've got a group for women who are in a relationship with a sex addict. So there's some information back there about that. We've got some groups for teens with social skills. And learning those social skills. And so there's all sorts of information back there. If you need it, grab it. We've got some brochures, too. If you need to resource your church or if you want to bring whatever it is back with you, feel free to grab those, too. And then the last thing is we open an office in Costa Mesa. And so we've got some cards back there that just show you where that Costa Mesa office is. It's real close to Bristol and Baker, close to Memphis, if you're familiar with that restaurant. So we're excited about that. We've got about a staff of 10 that are out there. So it's a really solid staff that we've put out there, and we're really excited about it. So let me just pray for us. And then if you can fill your cards out and drop them back there, that would be fantastic. Did I miss anything else? No? Okay, let me pray. God, thank you so much for just this morning and an opportunity to learn. And I thank you for Kevin and his intentionality and just studying and bringing this and engaging us in a dialogue and a discussion. And Lord, we know that this is just the beginning of a conversation, but we appreciate the opportunity to get in front of these numbers and be reminded of the hurting, the sick, the broken, that each of us deal with each and every day. We thank you for the reminders of that in ourselves, too. And we pray that you would just help us to take good care of our hearts, our souls. We pray that you would provide us in communities where we can just meet our relational needs, too, Lord, because we know that we can't do this alone. We know that you're with you, or you're with us, but we also know that we need each other, too. So we pray that you would just guide us and direct us, and thank you for just your love and your mercy and your grace and the knowledge that we are known by you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.